This is Hal Clifford, executive editor of Orion Magazine. I'm speaking today with Rebecca Claren, who's the author of Pesticide Drift in our July-August issue. Rebecca, thanks for talking with us today.
Great to be here.
Your story, Pesticide Drift, is set in the Central Valley of California. And this is a mythic landscape for Americans. It's a place that we're led to believe feeds much of the nation today. And many of us, certainly myself, and probably thanks to John Steinbeck and all that art on the fruit crates, we probably have a romantic view of the valley. What's the reality that you experienced when you went there to report this story?
My reality, when I went there, it was in August. It's a hot, baked landscape. This is a place that I think it feels like when you're there has been forgotten. It's a forgotten place in America at this point. You walk into these small towns, which literally are one street long. Most of the streets in town aren't necessarily paved. You've got rows and rows and rows of cotton fields coming right up to the edge of town. Very poor places. People, majority of them, immigrants in many of these towns in the Central Valley. Poor, uneducated, without many resources at all in the town.
Did it surprise you to find this, or in your other reporting, or have you already sort of been familiar with the situation there?
I've been writing about farm worker communities for a long time, but I was surprised at how sort of desolate these places were, especially because they're so close to the interstate. I mean, this isn't like the panhandle Immokalee in Florida, which is down, you know, so south, or Homestead. You know, this is, you know, within 10 miles of I-5, and yet you go off the interstate, and it's not necessarily a place many people will visit, to say that.
I remember when we were working on this story together, you suggested that it just didn't feel like this place was part of America, which is such an odd thing to hear from you, because it seems so central to the American idea, certainly the idea of manifest destiny and so on. And is it, I mean, you described a little bit of that, but was there more to it? Is it the way the landscape has been treated itself, or is it really what you were talking about had to do with the towns?
Yeah, it didn't feel like America to me, in that most people there are speaking not English, but Spanish. You don't have sort of the basic things we think about in America. Think of the walking postman. They don't have one there. You don't have high school. You know, this is a town, a very big town. These are big towns, thousands of people. They don't have high schools there. They have to go to the next town over. You don't have ambulances. I mean, sort of basic things we think about that are sort of central to the Norman Rockwell picture of what happens in small-town rural America aren't happening there. I mean, even the city manager, for God's sakes, lives in Fresno, which is an hour away. But it's also different than the idea we have of sort of this mythic idea of rural agrarian society, in that this is a place where it's not necessarily, especially the town of Huron, where I set the story on the ground, you don't have, you know, necessarily white picket-fenced farmhouse surrounded by fields, and maybe there's some workers there that live on site. You know, you've got basically an entire town that houses the workers, and it seemed to me, from being there anyway, that, you know, these are corporate farms, these are big corporate ag operations, and the people that are, at least in the area around Huron, the landowners aren't there.
You wrote about both Tulare and Fresno counties in the Central Valley, and the numbers in your story about the amount of pesticides sprayed on crops in these counties is truly astounding. It's millions of pounds a year. And I would expect that many Americans who live in cleaner environments just wouldn't put up with this going on all around them. Why is it that you think the people of Huron and surrounding towns have endured this kind of spraying and then the drift of some of that spray into their communities for so long?
Well, I think it's twofold. One, I think you've got a bigger tolerance for these this sorts of this is an industrialized landscape. These are people living on the edge of industry. Can't think of it any different than if these were people living near, you know, in southern Louisiana near the Gulf Coast. this is a place that was created to be the breadbasket of the country and to raise so much of our fruits and vegetables. And so you've got a place where the tolerance for industrial chemicals and practices that go along with being huge industrial agricultural landscapes just are more highly tolerated. That's the first thing. But secondly, these are places that most of these, the people that live in these communities are immigrants. They mostly speak English. How much of the time are they going to...
I'm sorry, mostly speak English or mostly speak Spanish?
Sorry, they mostly speak Spanish. Okay. They aren't necessarily aware of, even if they're second generation immigrants, it's really sort of insular communities. There's not even buses that take people regularly out of town. So, you know, how much are they aware of the laws and their rights and the options for this not to exist? Many people, estimates varied, but, I mean, many people told me it was as high as 90% of people in the valley. There's no good statistics, but are undocumented. So that right there, people are terrified of being deported and separated from their families who they may have children who were born in this country who are documented, and they don't want to risk speaking up and being separated from their families. So there's not a lot of political will necessarily to get involved and try and do something different.
One of the sources in your story, Tracy Breaker, who's an activist in the Bay Area, described the Central Valley as a source of great sort of civil rights ferment now, that this is a place of real struggle for civil rights, for farm workers, and that's how she was seeing this struggle against pesticides. Do you see that way?
Definitely. I think it's a great way to describe it. She said this is the sort of the center of civil rights movement in our country is the Central Valley. And that's because these are people who don't have many civil rights. They live in a landscape that is poisoning them, or they at least feel like it is. And so the effort and the impetus that is growing in this in these communities to try and be empowered and take charge of their situation are exactly the kinds of things that when you think about the civil rights movement of 30 years ago, 40 years ago, wasn't that exactly the aim? Think about what Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez were doing when they started the Farm Workers Union. It was to organize people to take control of their situation. And that is exactly the kinds of things that are now happening in the valley in regards to environmental and social issues there.
So your article describes the beginning of empowerment for the Latino communities in the Central Valley around this question of pesticide drift and incidental pesticide poisoning. Is this then the continuation of the movement that Chavez and Dolores Huerta started, or is this a new movement? Is this a merging of movements together into one thing? So, I mean, I'm fascinated by this idea of civil rights and justice and environmentalism coming together, and it's one of the reasons we like this story. But I'm wondering, given your regular work out in the field, sort of where does this particular story fit on that spectrum?
That's a really great question, actually. I mean, I think you can't see this as rewriting the book on civil rights issues. This is definitely a continuation out of the work that the Farm Workers Union did, and that Dolores Huerta, actually, with her foundation, is continuing to do in terms of organizing communities to take control of their situations and become empowered. What's different about this effort and what I think makes it significant in some ways is the use of science, is what the original civil rights movements, I mean, my understanding of them, especially in regards to farm workers, was labor union organizing, you know, taking it from there, looking at issues of policy and law, and, you know, it was the using the tools of strikes and writing letters to your politicians. Those are the same tools that people continue to use now in the activist community. What is different, and what I think makes this effort far more savvy, is the idea of saying, even though we have citizens here who are poor, who are not necessarily very well educated or even necessarily speak English very well, we're going to help them to do their own scientific research, to take water samples, to take air samples, to try and get federal and state and local regulators' attention by doing some of the work that these agencies aren't doing.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because critics of the federal and state governments in recent years have pointed to how a lot of these agencies have been defunded, are unable to do their work, or unwilling to do their work for ideological reasons, perhaps. And I'm wondering if what we're seeing here is perhaps a little bit of a silver lining in that cloud, that citizens are starting to do that work themselves, to become empowered to bring science to the table when they're bargaining for things. Am I reading too much into this, or do you sense that there is a broader movement in that direction out there, given your work as a reporter for many publications?
I think that's true. I think it actually happens always, though, don't you? I mean, I think it's what gives me great faith in the human in humanity, is that I see over and over again, whether it's Native Americans dealing with a lack of health care, or farm worker women who are facing sex assault and harassment on the job, that increasingly people who are beat down will eventually organize and in that lack of federal funding, in the lack of resources, find a way to take it on themselves. I mean, that's sort of the essence of grassroots activism in any regard. And I really do see that. I don't think it's anything new, necessarily. I think we've always seen that. And it's that idea that sometimes things have to get really bad, and give people long enough and give them a little bit of help and give them some tools on how to get started, and they will organize themselves to get things better, because people always want to make things better for their kids.
We've been talking with Rebecca Claren, the author of Pesticide Drift in the July-August issue of Orion Magazine. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Hal.